Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Mr. Justin Robert Young.
Hello. It's good to be back doing weird things, man. You're out there in the hinterlands of gorgeous Big Sky America. Brian is not going to be here today because he's vacationing good and hard out there in California. So it's just going to be me and you, but you're just rejoining civilization.
Dude, I started yesterday morning, walked out of a ranch house that's literally on the edge of Yellowstone, surrounded by National Park, had to get on a trailer, followed, watched two horse butts galloping for 11 miles to get to a transfer station, to get onto a car, and then to get to an airport and get on a plane and then come back to L.A.
So wait, hold on. Wait a minute. So you have to you have to not drive a car in this area, or is that just for
it's a ranch that got grandfathered in that area, so it's like literally you go through Yellowstone to get to it, you go to a transfer station where you get out of your vehicle and you get onto a horse or follow a trail to get there,
and that's like mandatory.
No.
You're not allowed, like, you can't
you
150 on there.
No, it's like breaking federal law if you take a car or any motorized vehicle off of the road in Yellowstone.
So it is Blazing Saddles for 11 miles. You watch it
too. Oh, yeah.
Clumping
so
along.
I hiked in, the week ago Saturday and then left yesterday. So it's kind of a weird experience because it's like, you start off by horse, then you get in your car, then you get to the airport, and I got an early flight. So I, left there, 8 o'clock, and then by like 4:30, I'm back in L.A. It's a weird, weird thing where half of your journey is going by horse.
Wow. Yeah. That is really, really rad. Now, you were out there for a meeting of the Illuminati or something, right?
Pretty much. I have a friend that's got a very cool, eclectic group of people he likes to bring together. And then, in the middle of the night, they wake me up and chase me with guns. It's my purpose there.
It is. You are indeed the most dangerous game, Andrew Main.
That was the first time I ever went there. I was afraid that was what was going to happen because, he's got, some neat people, some great scientists and other people there, and I'm like, why am I here? But I'm the dancing monkey.
and you dance oh so well, which is why they bring you back year after year. But we're glad that you are back here in the California territory where everybody, has – running lights and water, and everybody's allowed to drive their car wherever they damn well please without breaking federal law. And we're here to get weird. We've had a couple weeks off. We want to get back into the swing of things.
So I'll tell you, something kind of weird that happened when I was out there is, like, the day after I got into Yellowstone, I heard how they'd shut down some of the roads there because the thermal vents were getting so hot, they were actually melting the asphalt.
Really?
Yeah.
So, all right. And explain to me, like, I'm five, is this just, like, because of the geyser and the natural, like, kind of activity there? There's just the earth just needs to vent stuff, and every once in a while it melts the roads?
You're a very smart five-year-old. Exactly. So you have these thermal vents where you get water that gets superheated and comes to the surface. Sometimes it doesn't come to the surface. There's surface impeding it. In this case, there's road, so it just heats up the surrounding dirt and everything until the asphalt starts to melt.
Man, that would be really unfortunate if they were solar freaking roadways. That would be a much more expensive fix if they had LEDs and stuff like that were melting everything until the point where it was.
So is there anybody out there that still doesn't realize that's a dumb idea?
You know, if we talked about the videos by Thunderfoot a couple weeks ago in the back and forth on it, and they got really – that became its own little thing. And I guess that's where this discussion sort of went to die, is that we had the big initial viral pop where everybody kind of looked at it and on that big cursory glance, it's like, oh my God, look at that, solar roadways. It spreads all throughout the internet. Everybody high fives each other for believing in the future, and then that was it. And then it kind of devolved into this back and forth between, and I think a real personal back and forth between Thunderfoot, this YouTube guy, who was doing these rebuttal videos about why on a million different levels it was a dumb idea. And then the solar roadways people just doing these kind of battle rap essays about why Thunderfoot's point of view was stupid, and they went back and forth, and eventually the public at large kind of lost interest.
Mm. I didn't know there was a whole follow-up to that. That's amusing.
Yeah, yeah. And it's frustrating because, you know, there's – I think that there's interesting ideas in that, in the solar roadways thing. I think the larger, like the idea of having some element of smart roads is not something that is completely stupid. You know, I just think that the deployment and the way that they were talking about it was obviously flawed.
You get into this problem where, like, I would say we're very much idealists. We're very much optimists here.
Yeah.
But we pay attention to science and engineering. And by paying attention to it is we understand where the state of the art is here and where you need to get to there. And, you know, you get people like, we should build a space elevator. Well, there are a lot of problems with that. Space elevator may be a great idea, but getting from here to there, there's so many technological things you have to solve, and then all these political things you have to solve. Meanwhile, there are all these other awesome things we could be doing that are more practical. You know, it's imagine in the 1970s, we're like, we should build just one big, massive supercomputer that's centralized, you know, that can solve all our problems. Okay, well, that's at the expense of the personal computer and the development of the internet. And maybe that really, really, really big supermassive computer that was a, you know, combination of all of our computational resources would have been great and would have been where IBM's Watson is today or beyond, but we would have missed out on this other future because we have X number of resources to spend on this. And solar,
it's hard to understand that, you know, and have faith in our continued ability to not do the big pie in the sky thing because that other future awaits, right? You know, if to use your example, let's build a big centralized supercomputer. The element that is hard to think of in that moment is that there is this glorious future of personal computers and the internet and a decentralized force, right?
Yeah, it's not understanding the problem and all the opportunities, you know, and that's sort of the big thing is that, you know, like, solar roads. And that's if I didn't know anything about engineering or science, I'd be like, that sounds great. But finding places to put solar panels isn't a problem. So putting them on roads doesn't solve a problem. You know, it introduces all these other problems. And anyhow, we can digress into that. But you get that a lot where we go, we should have this, we should have that. But then these things, things are complex.
They are. And we need to understand that. Go ahead.
Speaking of complex things, Justin. Yeah. I don't even know what's going on in Siberia, but heard about this giant gaping hole in Siberia?
You know, if there's one thing I think about Russia is that they need more controversial elements to their society these days. You know, I feel like it's not weird enough in Russia, what with meteors and planes going down by way of rockets. You know, they need something weirder, which is why I'm really excited to hear about this Siberia thing because I have not been familiar with it.
So there's a city in Siberia called Yamal, which is supposed to be an end of the world, and a mysterious hole opened up with reports, some people saying it was as much as 300 feet across, but it turns out it's only 100 feet across, just popped up. All of a sudden there's a giant hole in the ground, big, massive hole.
Now, how rare is this really? I mean, like you hear periodically about sinkholes opening up, obviously to this size, you know, to varying sizes, some smaller than others. But the idea of sinkholes opening up seems like one of those things that we only care about because we have cameras and the internet and we can take a picture and diagram it and get it on Reddit within 5 minutes of it happening.
Well, this didn't necessarily appear to be a sinkhole. Now, a sinkhole has certain sort of criteria which you look at and you can understand it. This looked like something exploded out of the ground. And so that's what made this different than just looking at that. So I'll give you a Google link to go look at it so you can click on that. Just type in Yamal, Y-A-M-A-L, hole.
Holy crap. Man, this is a few tentacles short of a Sarlacc pit.
Dude. Oh, dude, it's totally Sarlacc pit. I was waiting for you to see that. Yeah, it's you know, I'm waiting for Boba Fett to come climbing out of there.
Wow, it's amazing because it looks almost like on purpose, right? Like, especially from a distance, the rim of it does not, like, it is jagged up top, but it almost looks like it has a smooth kind of finish to it, as if this were intentionally drilled in by a massive drill bit.
Like some sort of supervillain plan, like Mole Man. So scientists are there, and they seem reasonably confident that it's just like a methane explosion or something to that effect, which is, you know, totally reassuring.
Yes.
How many horror movies can we think that started like this? Remember Godzilla, the most recent Godzilla?
Godzilla had a sinkhole start. I think This Is the End began with sinkholes appearing throughout the
world. War of the Worlds had holes in the ground?
Yeah. No. Did you already say Tremors?
Mm-mm.
Tremors. There's another random hole in the ground starter.
So I was thinking, like, if it was Godzilla and it was, you know, some Mothra-like creature bursting out of the ground in an explosion, what would they show up and say? They'd be like, well, there's an explosion. Methane causes explosions. There's methane here.
Well, this
must be that.
Like, swamp gas is kind of – isn't that the cure-all when people like to make fun of the government explanations? Like, that was, yeah, like a Roswell explanation or any UFO stuff, is people saw lights in the sky because of swamp gas that happened to be emanating.
Yep. It's our ready-made explanation, and it's actually a practical explanation that makes a lot of sense. So I just kind of think, like, listen, it's all going according to plan if this is a horror movie.
Now, it also doesn't help that it's in Siberia, right? No. Like Siberia is
in
just
a city called End of the World.
Yeah, there's that as well, which is because that does itself no favors in terms of the poetic license to what could be an otherwise otherworldly tragedy waiting to happen. But is it just that there's so much that could be there in Siberia that we don't know about? Like, it could get out of that hole and a gigantic worm could be crawling around some area that nobody gives a rat's ass about, and we have no clue, uninhabited for years, right? I mean, this is the basis of almost all of our cryptozoological dreams.
Absolutely. There's Yeti stories there. That was where the Tunguska meteorite was in Siberia. And granted, Siberia is a massive area. That was there. It's kind of like Florida of the world. There's a I'm going to read to you the report from the scientists who investigated it. Conspiracy theorists who thought bombs or UFOs might be involved will be disappointed to hear the team's initial judgment. There is nothing mysterious here, said Andrea Plekhanov, one of the researchers speaking at the Siberian Times. It is simply Mother Nature's law with its internal pressure and changes in temperatures.
Wow. So a massive explosion. I mean, like, is there any description on there on what the level of, you know, explosiveness would have to happen to cause a hole like that? Like, is that, like, comparable to bring down a casino, an older casino in Las Vegas? That's got to be a massive explosion.
Yes, very big explosion. I don't know if they've actually estimated the size of it yet. I'll send you the link to the Siberian Times article. How would you like that beat?
What name in Siberian journalism? Winner of the Frosted Inkwell 19 years in a row.
Yeah, it's the bear paw editor's desk.
I will say this about Siberia. It looks like a fairly nice place to be during the summer. It gets a real bad rap as being a frozen poop hole for most of the year, but it doesn't look like bad weather out there right now.
Well, except for the exploding ground.
I mean, there is the gigantic ground explosion that just happened, which you have to imagine would not be something that would lure tourists to this particular area of Siberia. Holy crap, is that a massive crater. I just looked at like a big profile shot of kind of the entire, you know, ground there. And this is a massive mother humping crater.
Can I tell you why I need to spend more time looking at Siberian Times? Because if you look in the right, the news section there, there is some awesome stuff there. You know, there's bottom Siberia to get world's first cryo storage necropolis for woolly mammoths.
Oh, man. No, you're right. Because normally you go to, like, the British tabloids, right? And it's always like Kim Kardashian wore some sandals today, or you'll never believe what Jason Statham's ex-girlfriend did at a club. Like, it's always that kind of stuff. This is a little bit more where we have our natural interests as listeners and practitioners of this podcast. Let me read from the top. Scientists reveal a suspended Bronze Age murder and dental secrets from around 4,000 years ago. That is a headline, ladies and germs.
There's scientists study exact age of oldest wooden statue in the world. There, and it's this freaky 10-foot tall wooden statue that's 10,000 years old.
And how about this headline? The worm has turned ... luminous blue. That is the name of like a electric light orchestra box set. The word luminous blue. That's an amazing album name.
Now read new scientific discovery of a novel type of Luciferian.
I didn't think I loaded that one.
That was luminous blue.
Oh, is that it? Oh yeah, sorry, yeah. A new scientific discovery of a novel of Lucifer making the Siberian luminous earthworm glow in the dark. That's amazing. That worm has turned luminous blue. There ain't no BS about that.
Luciferian is the scientific term for a generic term for the light-emitting compound found in organisms that generate bioluminescence. Oh, morning star, do your contributions never end?
There we go. Check it out. Big shout out. This is our first Weird Things pick of the day is the Siberian Times. We are absolutely.
All right. Knows so that. A couple weeks ago, you know, you got some excited phone calls and text messages for me.
Yes. Now that is not uncommon there. I would categorize 80% of our communication as excited.
I'm a very excitable young man.
Well, now listen, you just see the wonder in the world, and nobody can blame you for that.
So, through a confluence of events, I got myself invited to this really cool program for it's a summer program. They invite hundreds of high school kids from around the world. They bring them to a college campus called Adventures of the Mind, and it was really cool. I got to hang out with James Elroy, meet him briefly, Amy Tan, some great scientists and other people there, some Nobel laureates, and 200 really cool kids just from, you know, from everywhere. And the kids were just great. And so I did a little presentation and then got to hang out and be kind of a mentor, if you will. Along the way, I met a really cool scientist named Lewis Lerman, who's he's done a lot of interesting things on the origins of life. He's done a lot of really cool engineering things. He designed the drone along with some other people that was used in Captain Phillips. That was like the one that actually they used to spy on the, you know, the pirates.
Oh, that's awesome.
He invited me to a virtual reality meetup. It's called VRLA. And so they do it every other month, and it's a bunch of people, virtual reality enthusiasts. And this was at the USC Center, the MXR lab, where they develop a lot of cool virtual reality technologies. And this is where Palmer Luckey is from. He's the guy who started Oculus Rift. So Palmer Luckey worked at the same lab. His desk is there. You can see the desk where he worked on the first versions of this. They had a lot of early technology that they used that played into developing this, and they had some really cool demos. So one of the demos I got to do is put on a VR helmet, and you walk around the center of this warehouse, but it makes it look like you're in an Afghan village, and you're searching for weapons. And so you open up a, you know, like jars, and you look into jars, you look inside of there trying to find a weapons cache. But what was cool about it is that it created this infinite space, because when you walked into a virtual room, they would move the door behind you to some other location. So when you left, you would walk back into the center of the real room. And as a way to create this space that went on and on and on and on. It's very, very, very clever. You used change blindness to create that illusion.
In the moment, did you feel like you were being manipulated, or did it just kind of hide in that blind spot of your brain that you don't always exactly remember where the door is? You just kind of follow the context clues.
I knew the door moved. I walked through and I knew the door moved, and I understood why. And I thought maybe they were doing some other subtler things, which they weren't, but it was just the door moved. I knew that, but it was very, if I'd been a little more distracted, I probably would not have known.
Yeah. And that's one of those things where it's like, you'll probably take that trade-off to have unrestricted physical movement. You know, if that's what just needs to happen, so you are always going to be able to walk around and not feel like you are hitting up against a physical barrier while in the virtual world, that's a trade-off.
Yeah, and there are a lot of other things that could be done to, and I think that's one great part of the toolbox to create, make an infinite space out of a small amount of space. And I think it's very, very exciting, because when you start thinking about the idea of creating infinite virtual worlds and getting into a world and be able to walk around and continuously go on, you're going to want, I mean, ideally you'd have some sort of holodeck type room with moving floors or whatever. But in this instance, the idea of being able to take a very small space and make it feel like a much larger space to these techniques. And there are other ways you can do that too. You know, other ways you can supplement that. And it's exciting to think that's what this is getting to the point where you put on the VR goggles and you walk around your apartment and it uses augmented reality to create a map and then create a space that adapts to that. That's cool.
So tell me how far off I am when I make this comparison to that group of people. Is this in the current point we are at in VR technology? Is that group that you visited akin to like the homebrew computer clubs that, you know, Wozniak included in the of the personal computer? Is that comparable to kind of to a layman to explain what that is?
I would say so. I think that there was what the lab worked on, and then outside they had, you know, a dozen tables with different people in groups showing off some of their stuff. Some of these were design students, some of these were companies. The difference between now and the Homebrew Computer Club, which famously was where Steve Wozniak presented the Apple I computer designs to, is that these people are all very commercially savvy. They're very aware of startups. They're very aware of the commercial opportunities of the stuff, which I think is fine. I think that's good. I think that, you know, the downside is that, you know, there may be a less of a justification for being okay to play and just create, which I think that that's the one downside. But yeah. I saw some great demos. I saw a guy that was using Oculus Rift to help people who had lazy eye, to help them train so the eyes could function together stereoscopically. It was a really cool demo. I've played some cool games, Couch Warrior, which is where you put on the helmet and you play against somebody else, and you're sitting in a virtual living room controlling these little elves that run around and jump on top of coffee tables fighting each other. And you see, you know, in the early stages of computing, you know, circa, you know, when the Apple I came out and the Homebrew Computing Club, we didn't know what less than 10 years later the average computer interface would even look like. Yeah. And you saw, you know, the Mac, you know, via Lisa, the Mac and the via Xerox PARC, Xerox earlier development, but the first real commercial graphical user interface via the Macintosh came out in 1984. 6 years, 5 years, 3 years prior, that was not an assumption you would make. 10 years later, every computer uses a graphical user interface. Nobody, except for the extreme techie kind of people, use a command prompt. But that was something we didn't know, and how should graphical user interfaces work? Windowing environment, the idea of creating multiple windows that you can go back and forth from was, you know, nobody assumed that was going to be likely necessarily, because you had to have multitasking or multi-threading, a lot of other things. So you're seeing a lot of the early problems, you know, being figured out. And that's with Oculus Rift, the Oculus Rift version 2 coming out now. I have one of those on pre-order. You see these things, and how do you interface with it? What's the best way when you have this thing on to give it instructions? Should you hold a keyboard? Should you hold a joystick? Should it watch your hands? And figuring out, like, games. You know, one of the things you're not going to want to necessarily play games where you're watching from a first-person point of view running around, because although that seems cool, you can turn your head and look in all these different directions. You're not physically moving, and so that can create motion sickness.
It's obviously a very promising yet still kind of nascent technology, right? Because the Oculus, if you buy an Oculus, you are buying it as a beta, if not developer thing still.
Right? Yeah, I mean, it's next year they'll probably have the commercial version.
Yeah.
So
and
it was
already got sold to Facebook. I mean, that's why it is so promising, is that even though you have to buy it under this idea that, you know, you are developing for it, or you are just understanding that you are buying something that will not be what it could be if they were going to sell it at Kmart and Best Buy, this is so promising that Facebook dropped the kind of coin that they did.
And at Google I.O., you know, I went to this meetup, was very excited by what I saw. I went on Amazon and I started buying lenses and kits and stuff, because they have a project called FOV2Go, which is how you turn an iPhone or an Android into a stereoscopic 3D immersive viewer. I said, I'm going to go build one. 3 days later, at Google I.O., they revealed Google Cardboard, which is their whole project for virtual reality, and that's their new platform they're developing. So I built a Google Cardboard. I've got my apartment here. I've got tons of stuff. I've got the Gervos Dive. This is a device where you plug your iPhone into, and you can run stereoscopic apps and stuff and see 3D. So it's kind of essentially like an Oculus Rift. You know, it's not got all. I think the Oculus Rift has got better screens and all that, but a lot of the same functionality. These are coming out now where you're going to be able to buy, you know, $30, $40 devices that you just plug your existing smartphone into, because your smartphone has a very good screen. It has accelerometers, and it can sense where you look in space. I made a Google Cardboard. I've taken it and shown it to just lay people just to see their reactions. People flip out over it. You know, for Cardboard, they have this game that – or not a game, but it's a short film that feels like you're in the middle of an animated film where you can turn around and look in any direction. And it's lay people get it. Lay people are excited about it.
Yeah.
So now is the time to experiment and play with this and come up with really practical or fun things to do inside of there, other than just go, isn't that cool?
So where do you see it going? What is the touchstone for the popular aesthetic of a technology crazy universe? Like, what is the thing that needs to happen to make it blow up?
So you're going to get, you know, the gamers are going to do a good job of blowing it up within gaming. It's going to become a great game accessory, and there's going to be some games that are better than others to play in it. And so that's going to happen naturally, and that's the people who are most excited about Oculus. A number of game developers have already built in Oculus compatibility into their game, so it can output the 3D stereoscopic views that feeds into it. That's going to happen naturally. The other thing we want to see is what happens to casual gaming and what happens to storytelling. What's going to make it compelling for, you know, guys like you and I, who are not, we're casual gamers, but we're not hardcore Xbox or PlayStation gamers.
Yeah.
What's going to be the thing that's going to want to make you strap this thing on your head for half an hour? And, you know, if it's immersive cinema, which is going to be storytelling without necessarily gameplay, you need to have a story that's very compelling to be told in this way and not just watch it on a screen. That's, you know, one of the biggest arguments I've always thought against 3D is people will go to the movie theater and go watch a movie in 3D as sort of kind of a novelty thing, but nobody cared enough to ever buy a 3D TV or a 3D version of a movie, because it never added enough. Nobody's watching Avatar at home and going, I'm just missing out, you know?
Yeah. That HD was, where all of a sudden you went to a friend's house, you saw an HD television for the first time, and you're like, wow, this radically changes how I view things. Now they look completely different. That was not like that for 3D.
And I'll say, even with that, you know, think about it, is the number of times people are watching SD images with just upscaling or whatever and don't realize they're not watching HD. I think watch streaming stuff on Netflix or cable. I go over to people's houses all the time, and they're watching the SD channel, but it just spread across a letterbox, and they don't know, you know, or they're watching a, you know, I hate, like, TNT would do that stretched, they would just take a 4-3 signal and stretch it into 16-9, which I think is just, there's got to be a ring of hell for people who do that. And a lot of people don't even notice that, you know, so it's that shows you how difficult it is. You've got to make it really compelling.
Yeah.
It's exciting though. If you want, go to google.com/cardboard. And if you have an Android phone, I went out and I ordered a Nexus 5 just to be able to do this. You can order, it's not google.com/cardboard. I made that up. It's g.co/cardboard. You can go there and you can, with a couple lenses, if you want some advice on how to make this without the special lenses that they suggest, you can go to, if you type in FOV to go, FOV, the number 2, and then go, they suggest lenses you can just go. This is the USC lab where they show different kinds of lenses and stuff you can use, where I went to, you can go to Office Depot and buy magnifying glasses with the lenses that you can use to make this. So, it's a fun little kit.
To be fair, and granted, we are all not Andrew Main in terms of our industriousness, but if you dare to dream, you built your own version of it.
I built, the first thing I built was before Google revealed theirs, is I built my own FOV to go based upon what I saw on the, you know, based on there using an iPhone. I actually made a head-mounted cardboard display because I'm a dork. But what you can do now is you can actually go to Amazon, and if you type in Google Cardboard, you'll see a ton of kits pop up, which are cardboard with lenses, and they're like between $20 and $30. I've seen some of these here that are like I see for $14 plus shipping. There's a Google Cardboard kit with the lenses and everything you need. So for, you know, $20, you can turn your Nexus handset or your Google handset, your latest Android handset, into a VR viewer.
That is amazing. That is something that if you are into this, I would love to see a little community of people who are building these spring up around the Weird Things podcast, because I think it could be something really, really special to just see that development community happen around. I mean, it could really pop up around anywhere, so why not this podcast?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Let us know if you're playing around with what you're doing. I've got an apartment full of gear and stuff and other little projects I've been working on. I put up on my Tumblr a week ago, I put up a how to make your own 3D camera system for $160 using a toy 3D viewer from Hasbro, two $67 little action cams and ski goggles. I'm able to make a viewer that you can actually see in real time 3D and then make pretty good 3D movies with it. You know, you can just strap two cameras next to each other, but you have issues of parallax, and if something's slightly a little tilted or panned, you're not going to get the image that you really need to get good 3D. So I made this viewer to be able to do that. So,
and I'll tell you what, there's a moment happening, because I've talked to you a lot about the VR stuff. You've gotten very excited about it. Next thing you know, I go to an accountant. I want to get some of my tax stuff in order. So I go to my accountant, and he, on the way out, just a random parting thing. And granted, this is probably a little of the fact that this guy was a San Francisco-based new media accountant. But he's like, so just so you know, my development company is building the first horror movie developed exclusively for Oculus Rift. And I'm like, that's so funny. Like, I have a friend of mine that's really, really into it. But I think it's one of those things where people who are always looking for the hot new thing, we are in a moment of maturity for mobile computing, for tablets. We're seeing a lot of those platforms get perfected as opposed to developed. And meanwhile, for anybody who's into the new hotness, that rush of new, virtual reality is there for you.
Yeah, there are a lot of first horror movies for Oculus Rift being shot right now. I can tell you that.
He's a very nice account.
No. I know. This is the exciting thing about it, is that, you know, that there's a lot of people excited about it, and the first thing everybody goes is, horror movie! And that's the thing, is there's going to be a low-hanging fruit, and then it's you know, when the video games came out, or excuse me, when the computer, the home computer came out, you know, gaming for the first part consisted of a lot of text adventures.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, well, it'll be text adventures. We'll make text adventures. And text adventures can be great, but it was then you start to realize these other ways in which you can use that. So, any event, I think it's very, very exciting time.
I don't think there's any other way to say it. If you want to get on this train, man, you better start working on it now because it's only going to get more and more exciting.
So, you want to jump right into picks?
Let's go into picks.
I have two picks. One of the people I had the pleasure of hanging out with in the Montana enclave is David Kaplan. David Kaplan is a producer, but he's actually a physicist. He was a physicist working on trying to track down the Higgs boson, right? And in a very, very exciting time for particle physics, and he's thinking to himself, man, you know, somebody should make a documentary about this. I mean, that'd be really cool if somebody made a documentary about it. And he said, well, maybe I should just start shooting stuff. So he started shooting some footage. Finally, he got enough footage, and he got Mark Levinson interested in it. And Levinson is a film director. He's actually done a lot of other behind-the-scenes stuff, worked on other things, and this was his first, I think this is his first documentary. And they started working on it several years ago, and they got Walter Mersch, famed editor, who did such movies as The Godfather, to come in and do an edit of it. So Walter Mersch was involved with it, so it's just a lot of really great people on it, and it's gotten a ton of attention now, but it's a very, very fascinating documentary about this very exciting point at which they use, you know, the Large Hadron Collider to try to detect this fundamental building block of the universe. And so that's called Particle Fever. And right now it's available for rental and for purchase on iTunes, so you can jump on over and check it out. If you love science and want to see scientists pursuing one of these fundamental questions, it's you know, a great place to go for that.
But you know, and it also seems like it's got a sense for explaining why this is important and bringing out the human elements of a very scientific pursuit that has wide-ranging implications, which is always the best way to do it.
Yeah, and you know, David, who is the producer of it, he's a brilliant physicist. And he's also, you know, a really neat – I've watched him explain things to people of very minimal education, to people highly educated. I watch him take very, very complicated things and explain them. He's a very, very powerful explainer, and he's a brilliant guy. And so, you know, seeing somebody who's coming from this side of it, from really, really deep in the trenches of trying to figure out what's going on, make this project happen is pretty awesome.
Absolutely. No, I'm looking forward to watching it. I watched a movie yesterday. I went and saw Edge of Tomorrow, starring Mr. Tom Cruise, written by Chris McQuarrie, the guy who wrote Usual Suspects and Way of the Gun and some other good flicks. I really, really enjoyed it. I mean, granted, I was joking around. I did a podcast with Brett. The Amtrak Aroundsville last night after we saw it, because we were so excited about the idea of starting a Groundhog Day franchise, that there's no genre that you would not want to see a Groundhog Day conceit layered on top of. And this
right.
is certainly a proof of that. And that'll be the next Jury podcast. You can download it next Tuesday. But
yeah, there's like a new teen movie coming out with that theme too.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah, there actually are like a handful of movies coming out that are used. I guess people said, we've waited long enough. Let's just use that premise.
It's I'm saying just call it Groundhog Day, colon, whatever you need. Just name
the We'll have found footage. We'll have Groundhog Day.
Yeah. It's about this movie, and I didn't really get into this in the podcast, but to me it really kind of – It made me wish that the excitement and out-of-the-box praise that we gave something like Pacific Rim was there for Edge of Tomorrow, and the kind of ambivalence that was there for Edge of Tomorrow was there for Pacific Rim. Because they're not dissimilar movies. And in what makes Edge of Tomorrow special, beyond the Groundhog Day conceit, which is done very, very well, there is just some really solid, fun science fiction world building that is similar to Pacific Rim. It's an unknown alien force that kind of comes out of nowhere and starts rapidly demolishing humanity faster than we can really understand it. We need to figure out and build new robotic technology to fight against them. Granted, in Edge of Tomorrow, it's far smaller than the Jaegers in Pacific Rim. But everything done from there, in my mind, in Edge of Tomorrow, is so much more compelling than Pacific Rim. I care about all these characters. They all have arcs to them. The universe makes a lot more sense to me, even in this weird time travel-y conceit. It was just really, really fun. And also, it's one of those things where Tom Cruise does a bunch of kind of crap movies, and you're like, oh, God, Tom Cruise. Then you see Tom Cruise in a good movie, and you're like, man, Tom Cruise. Tom Cruise. I like watching that dude run and shoot things.
I loved it. I mean, not to try to compare it to that other movie, I really loved Edge of Tomorrow in comparison. I thought it was fun. It felt kind of like a classic sci-fi, really well told with good characters. There was the problem in science fiction films often is people say, well, if they want to go deeper and make a message to it, it ends up being very nihilistic, or it's just, you know, and everybody dies kind of thing. And that's the problem, is there are cliches that people who think they're avoiding cliches jump right into, and that's worse to me than just doing a cliche very, very well. I think that Edge of Tomorrow, I have thoroughly enjoyed it. I thought that, you know, where Oblivion, you know, the last Tom Cruise in the future kind of movie was certainly beautiful, just sort of left you kind of going, okay. I thought this was just a much more complete movie. And, you know, I was excited about this when I heard that Doug Liman was doing this. And he's done, you know, I think he's one of these people that if people were a little bit more aware of thinking like, you know, this is the guy that did Bourne Identity. This is the guy that did, you know, Mr. and Mrs. Smith. You know, he's done some really, really good movies, Swingers. You know, he's a very good director that takes, you know, really good material and I think elevates it.
And what I like the best about the use of the conceit is that, you know, it's you know, it's easy and fun to just kind of joke about it as Groundhog Day colon sci-fi war movie, but the conceit is used in a really interesting way when you look at how it's weaved into why the war is going the way it's going and these very simple elements that are set up in the first 10 minutes via a news montage. It makes sense enough for me to care about the power, enough for me to care about where it is, why it's doing what it's doing, and when it goes away, or if it goes away, that I care about it.
A thing it did really well too was once you got the conceit, it moved forward. And there is a tendency in some films like the conceit is the whole thing, and they'll just keep playing that back over and over and over again and say, well, isn't it kind of cool that we can do this? Where here, it's like once you kind of got it, they just said, okay, we think people's patience for this is done. We're going to kind of move this story in a new way and get this really, really going, which I dug. And then at a point where you're trying to catch up, which I thought was cool.
Yeah, because at some point you kind of lose – you are no longer at – you are more in the point of view story-wise of Emily Blunt or mm-hmm. the other characters that are not experiencing this kind of stuff, then you are Tom Cruise. Initially, you were kind of with him with every day, and then at some point, he is ahead of the audience, which is really, really fun. So super recommended. It's still in theaters. If you happen to be in the Bay Area, I went to a really cool theater called the New Parkway, which is kind of Oakland's own Alamo Draft House, but it was super cool. If you're a second run at specialty, go ahead and pick that up. You are in the Bay Area.
All right, I'm gonna get into my big pick here.
Another pick, dual picks.
Dual pick. So here is the thing. I'm gonna make my case for this film, and I do so at the risk of maybe overselling some people who may be disappointed. And that is the risk anytime you want to enthusiastically say how much you love something. Yeah. But I'm going to go ahead anyways, because if you can't love this thing, we can't be friends.
Okay. So you are throwing down the gauntlet. You are saying if this is not your jam, then I don't want no part of you.
If you were to ask me what was the best science fiction film in the last 10 years, Inception. Oh, go ahead.
We talked about this. Yeah, and Inception, I think, would be the pick.
Yeah, so that's our pick. I'd probably say arguably Inception. There have been better films, but I think better films that were using, you know, science fiction, and I think as far as better films, last 10 years, Inception's really at that very, very small list at the top, just as an overall movie. And best science fiction film prior to Inception, maybe, I don't have to think. I would say, actually, I mean, like, too, like, I'd say Her, maybe, you know, is after post-Inception.
You would get people who would say Gravity. The Gravity is a
good point. Good point. And Gravity is not so much science fiction though too, because it uses a very realistic, and despite what some famous astronomer has said, has a lot more accuracy than he.
And not to say that what happens in Gravity is not is fictitious, you know, or cannot happen in the real world. Yeah. Rather that it is a science based tale that is invented and not documentary, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we can get into splitting hairs as to what that means, because if it's like, you know, anything that uses computers or technology, is it then?
Yeah, science? Is that science fiction?
Yeah, right. But anyway, I think Gravity's great, Her's great, Inception. These are all great films. These are all great films.
Rare air here, and leading up to something.
But what, as far as big science fiction, big concept, like Inception, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, and just as a movie in general, it is my favorite movie of the year so far.
And that is something. I mean, you are definitely a huge fan of this franchise. You very much like the previous one, but
against my will, I was the first one won me over. The first one I went to trepidatiously. I had a lot of hesitancy about, and then the first one, by the end of it, I go, man, this is a really well done film. And I've watched it again and go, this really holds up. In Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, amazing. Well, it is.
Real quick, let's go back to Rise for a second, because I finally watched Rise. I had never gotten around to watching it. I knew I wanted to watch Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. And I haven't seen that yet, but I have seen Rise. And that is an amazing script, you know, in that to make a non-English-speaking character, for the majority of the movie, so compelling and so amazing, and yet I still found myself at some point not believing that James Franco is a revolutionary scientist. However, more importantly, I did believe him as somebody who wanted to raise a monkey. And that is the more important element of that story. I thought it was excellent.
Yeah, he was the biggest problem I had going into it, was James Franco as the brilliant scientist. It's like, you know, Keanu Reeves in certain roles, and like, who I love, but I'm like, that was my biggest thing, but it wasn't about him.
No. And everything that was about him being a father.
Yeah. And remember, you have an amazing John Lithgow performance in there.
Great. Holy smokes. That took me by surprise.
Yeah. And so you get some of John Lithgow's best work is in there. And so anyhow, Rise of the Planet of the Apes, I watched that, and the end of it, I'm like, I really like this. I was expecting to not like this, and I loved it. Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, I loved. I absolutely loved. Because it's about the monkeys. It's about them. And instead of it being this, you know, Walking Dead story of how these humans are going to go survive with these, you know, evil monkeys out there, it's about how are these monkeys going to survive with these edgy humans around them.
Yeah.
It was so well told. Every single character in there had an arc. Every single character, I thought, I understood their motivations. And if somebody acted in an angry or violent way, I understood why, and you were somewhat sympathetic as to why they did that. If somebody acted in a dumb way, you understood why, because maybe they were young or just scared or whatever. It was such you could put humans into all the roles. You could have made it a story. Obviously, it felt like a story between, you know, humans and could have been like Native Americans, you know, different human groups fighting against each other. It could have been, you know, any sort of classic story about the confrontation between two cultures. I thought it was just so well done. And, you know, listen, I know there are people who are like, the special effects. Like, I don't believe you. People who say they don't buy the special effects. It's just that they can't wrap their head around, they're watching a talking monkey or whatever. Special effects in this are amazing. And I'm the guy that's first to criticize and point out where things just don't work. You know, Polar Express still gives me nightmares. Special effects are fantastic.
Yeah, and I talked to you right after you saw this, and you were of the agreement that we might see the Caesar role by Andy Serkis nominated for an Academy Award.
I think it's worthy of that. Whether or not they will do that, I don't know. But I think that his performance there and the performance of the other apes in that movie are amazing. You know, Korba has his own, you know, the way that he's acted out. Caesar's son is just very, very, very well done. I get them. I got them. I understood them and related them more than most human characters I see in other films.
Now, just for anybody who liked Rise of the Apes, the Dawn of the Apes skips ahead 10 years, right?
10 years.
Which apparently the director had to fight for. That the initially the studio wanted to follow our human characters going forward, and the director Matt Reeves was pretty adamant that you can't waste the fact that you built one of the most compelling non-human characters in the history of cinema in the first one, and then not wrap the movie around the most interesting next step for him.
And it's a great choice. Now they did. There are three prequel films that take place between Rise and Dawn that you can see on YouTube, and they take place. One is like 1 year after, one's like 5 years after, one's like 10 years after or something. And I got excited about this, how much high off of this film. I'm like, oh, I want to go see these. Couldn't finish any of them.
Really?
Because they're all about the humans.
Oh.
They're all about the humans, what? And it's
games for YouTube videos.
Yeah, I mean, it was like all about the humans, and it was like, I'm like, yeah, this feels like Walking Dead or something else. These might be really well told, but also they suffer from, you know, the short film thing, lots of musical montages and things to force emotions on you, et cetera, which drives me nuts. And I'm sure they're very well done, but it was just, it's like, I'm trying to figure out, like, an example. It'd be like, you come out of watching Star Wars, and, you know, it's you're going to find out, like, oh, we've got a four-minute film on repairing, you know, moisture harvesters. You know?
Hey man, don't speak too loud. You're gonna see that as sponsored by Kellogg's in the next year and a half.
Well, I'm kind of thinking I might actually want to watch that though. So.
And by the way, because this is the internet and there is a new Star Wars movie come out, we cannot talk about any films without mentioning some sort of Star Wars tie-in, which apparently this was again from Matt Reeves. I think it was the Slash film. That Andy Serkis was cast in Episode 7 after Matt Reeves, good friends with J.J. Abrams, saw or showed J.J. some pre-CGI performance of Andy Serkis playing Caesar, and J.J. Abrams was absolutely blown away, and that was apparently part of the reason. I mean, certainly Andy Serkis had made his name very well known with Lord of the Rings and King Kong and so much other stuff, and Nikola Tesla's Body Man in The Prestige. Before this, but great stuff. Excited to see where he goes from here.
I can't wait for you to see Dawn. Again, don't, you know, downplay my
your salesman as the best big concept science fiction movie of the last 10 years
since Inception. Yeah, downplay that. Just go see it. And there's it's one of those things too where they did a really good job of like some of the clips you've seen in the trailer. And then you watch, like, the opening sequence, you see something, and then you see the fuller sequence of what that is, and it's like, oh, this is so much cooler than what I thought was going on.
Well, I am pumped. All right, guys. Well, that about wraps it up for this episode of the Weird Things podcast. Thank you for hanging out. Hopefully next week we'll be able to set it up so Brian will be able to come back amongst him hitting the surf and sands on his L.A. vacation. But Andrew, there's a thing you say to end the show.
I can't get to that. I can tell you, though, without Brian, it's been really weird.
Mm.